the emergent school itself, K-6, is not standing.
Fire engulfs a school building in Bethel. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Senate votes to buy out TransCanada and have the state take a bigger stake in the Alaska LNG project.
And that is of great value as we contemplate a project of this magnitude.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
Emergency crews remain on site at the Kilbuck campus in Bethel after flames broke out early this morning, demolishing the school.
The actual emergent school is flat. The emergent school itself, K-6, is not standing.
Joshua Gill is with the Lower Kuskokwim School District. The immersion school is a charter elementary UPIC school. Also destroyed are the operation and maintenance sections of the campus and the lockers holding the students' school supplies. The Bethel Fire Department received a call at 3:46 a.m. that sewer pipes outside the building were smoking. They responded immediately and attempted to contain the fire, but it had spread inside the building. Excavators tore through the building, ripping the structure in half to isolate the flames to one wing of the school. Backhoes also ripped sections away from the front part of the building to prevent flames from spreading to the adjacent armory, which stands intact. Also standing is the wing housing the media center, containing UPIC artifacts and hundreds of UPIC elder interviews, though heavy smoke and water damage is expected. But Gill says the UPIC instructional materials are lost.
There was a lot of age in the materials and a lot of personal blood, sweat, and tears put into them that definitely we're not going to be able to replace. But until we get in there and assess, we really don't know. That was all created in-house here in LKSD with our folks.
The Kuskokwim Learning Academy School and dorm are standing but inoperable because of smoke and water damage. KLA is a residential alternative high school. Students evacuated the KLA dorms around 3:45 this morning after a fire alarm sounded. Most exited wearing pajamas. Personnel transferred the students to a school district building where social workers are offering counseling. Meanwhile, the Bethel community has mobilized. Organizations are gathering supplies for donations and offering buildings to serve as temporary classrooms. And the community pool opened its doors to the displaced students for the day. Emergency efforts are ongoing. No reports of injury have occurred. Municipal officials in Sitka were briefed about the repeated tasering of a teen in police custody shortly after the incident occurred in September of last year. In a press conference this morning, Sitka's administrator and police chief said that the use of force against the 18-year-old conformed to police department policies, and both told about their own experience being tased earlier in the day.
Any use of force above routine handcuffing in the Sitka Police Department is subject to review. When 18-year-old Franklin Hugendorn was arrested on multiple charges of disorderly conduct and underage drinking last year, and subsequently stripped and tased in his jail cell by three Sitka police officers, the incident made it to the administrator's desk.
Chief Schmidt informed me about this event shortly after it happened 14 months ago. He assured me that protocols were followed, that it was investigated, and corrective actions were taken. So this was not new to City Hall.
Mark Gorman is Sitka's municipal administrator. He says he was unable to publicly discuss the case at the time since it was in active litigation. Gorman and Police Chief Sheldon Schmidt met with local media to review the Hugendorn case only after a video of the jail cell tasering was posted on social media.
I did make a determination that this was within policy, that the actions of the officers were within policy. despite the fact that it doesn't look good.
Chief Schmidt sat before reporters with a list of departmental policies. KCAW's request for that list of the policies was denied by Municipal Attorney Robin Kocek on grounds that its release could jeopardize police investigations. But Schmidt did describe the procedures police follow when they take someone into custody.
For instance, you're going to be handcuffed behind your back, you're going to be searched, you're going to be brought to jail, you're going to be strip searched. People don't often know that, and there's very good reasons for that procedure. We've had contraband smuggled into the jail several times this year.
In the video, Hoogendoorn is physically stripped by the Sitka jailer and two officers. He's forced to his knees and then onto his belly with his hands and feet restrained from behind. Schmidt says that most people brought into custody aren't handled this way. They're allowed to step behind a screen and remove their clothing. After a search, they put on a jumpsuit. Hoogendoorn is repeatedly tased in the video and left motionless, face down on a plastic mat, wearing only his underwear. Schmidt says that Hoogendoorn was not being punished. He was being forced to comply with the officers.
Now, you can't see that very well on the videotape, but he's not giving them their hands. He's pushing off. At one point, he tries to kick the officers. And having just fought with them, they're still concerned that he's going to fight more. So hence the use of the taser. They're trying to get him to comply.
All charges were subsequently dismissed against Hoogendoorn. According to court records, the Public Defender Agency obtained detailed personnel records of one of the officers who arrested Hoogendoorn, Jonathan Kelton, who was involved in a fatal tasering incident in Roswell, New Mexico in 2013. The victim in that incident, Cody Towler, stopped breathing after being tased in a violent encounter with police. Although the death was ruled a homicide, Kelton and his fellow officers were exonerated when autopsy reports showed evidence that Towler's health was severely impaired by drug use. An incident report filed by the state of New Mexico indicates that Towler was able to overcome the electric current and pull the taser prongs from his chest. Sitka Administrator Mark Gorman might find that detail hard to accept.
I was just tased 45 minutes ago. I went up to the police department. Sheldon was before me on the ground and was tased, and I was tased by an officer in the leg.
Gorman says it was very uncomfortable, and he would have complied with any request of the officer administering it. Chief Sheldon Schmidt says Hoogendoorn's ability to withstand multiple taserings is significant.
It's pretty astounding that the young man was tased multiple times and didn't comply, that he was able to.
Yeah.
Because immediately you want to do. It hurts.
Schmidt and Gorman say they both will remain available to speak with residents about the issue. They'd like to rebuild trust in the community. Although Jonathan Kelton left the department in September of this year, the others remain. All are good officers, Schmidt says. And Gorman is keeping his line open to the Sitka tribe and other cultural leaders about another significant detail in the incident. Hoogendoorn is Alaska Native, and the three officers who left him stunned and motionless are not.
There's a national spotlight on this issue. The fact that it was a young Native male is concerning. We certainly want to be sensitive to that as well. Anybody looking at that video can't come away without questions and feeling a little disturbed.
Gorman says, "We have the responsibility to remain accountable to the public." Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
The state Senate voted 19-3 today to buy out TransCanada and take a larger stake in the Alaska LNG natural gas pipeline. APRN's Rachel Waldholz reports.
The vote is a win for Governor Bill Walker, whose administration has argued that keeping TransCanada as a partner doesn't make financial sense, and a buyout would give Alaska more control over the proposed mega project, which the state is developing along with ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. The bill must still be approved by the House. It's expected to vote later this week. Anchorage Republican Pete Kelly, co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee, said he arrived in Juneau 11 days ago opposed to the bill. But he said he was convinced that TransCanada itself wants out of the partnership and that buying them out now would ultimately cost the state less than keeping them in.
Another thing that it gives us, besides some of the financial advantages, is that we are closer to the project. We have a seat at the table. We're involved in decisions as we go forward. And that is of great value as we contemplate a project of this magnitude.
Anchorage Democrat Bill Willichowski said he favors the buyout for the same reasons he opposed the original deal under former Governor Sean Parnell. That deal, in 2014, ended the state's partnership with TransCanada in a previous pipeline project, the Alaska Gas Line Inducement Act, or AGIA, and brought the company into the current Alaska LNG project.
But the deal that was struck by the prior administration was not a good one. When the time came to strike a bargain, TransCanada bargained hard. They did what they were supposed to do for their shareholders, and they got a good deal. Unfortunately, that deal came at the expense of the people of Alaska.
Meanwhile, Wasilla Republican Mike Dunleavy, one of three no votes, said that after a week and a half of hearings, he still isn't convinced the administration has a clear plan for the gas line going forward. He said it seems like different state agencies are working against each other.
As I stand here today and I speak to this body, I've got some serious concerns. There were questions that went unanswered. I believe the onus was on the administration to prove to me that we're headed in the right direction. And personally, I think it came up short.
Dunleavy said he hoped his vote would send a message to the administration on getting its act together. The bill would allow the state to spend about $157 million to buy out TransCanada, continue work on the project's early planning phase, and fund state agencies for their work on the project. It's about $600,000 less than the administration originally asked for after agencies revised their request. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a daytime activity center for people with Alzheimer's disease.
They need somebody to say, hey, it's time for us to stand up. We've been sitting for a while, or I want us to do this activity together and I need your help.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence, and by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Russia is still on good terms with the U.S. in the Arctic, where their coast guards cooperate. But since Moscow annexed Crimea, Americans have been warily eyeing President Vladimir Putin's military buildup in the far north. At a U.S. Senate hearing today, witnesses describe Putin more as a cunning bully than a good neighbor. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The hearing in the Foreign Relations Committee was all about Europe, not the Arctic. Specifically, it was about Putin's propaganda strategy. But a portrait of Putin emerged from the Russian experts who testified, and the image has fangs. As they described it, Russia uses its English language RT news channel and other platforms to push all kinds of half-truths and hoaxes. The goal is to feed conspiracy theories and sow doubt.
They're not trying to get Putin's pew numbers up. Yeah? They're just trying to erode faith in democratic systems elsewhere. Putin doesn't want to be loved internationally. He wants to be feared. That's a very, very different kind of process.
Peter Pomerantsev is a fellow at the Legatum Institute, a London-based think tank. He says Putin is trying to undermine America and all it stands for, both in the information realm and on the ground.
The aim is never Crimea or Syria. Their aim is you. Yeah? They're after you. They want to psychologically prove that America is impotent. Therefore, the Pax Americana, for what it still is pointless. And therefore, why don't we be more corrupt, more violent?
A senator on the panel asked about Putin's popularity at home. Pomerantsev says it's hard to measure.
But without a doubt, I mean, there's been an emotional, catharsis from the Crimean experience. The question is, how deep does that go? Is that like a football match? Yeah, we got Crimea. Now where's our food? Or is that actually something deeper, and will it take us somewhere very, very dark?
Heather Conley is a Europe and Arctic expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She says America needs to re-engage in civil life in Europe as it did when new democracies were sprouting in the former Eastern Bloc. Conley warns it won't be an easy sell to taxpayers.
But that's about how we build the antibodies to growing Russian influence, because if we're not there, Russia will step in.
Conley says information infrastructure is at risk, too. She says Russian submarines have been examining the locations of Europe's undersea fiber optic cables. Severing those, Conley says, could disrupt internet service, essential commerce, and military command and control.
In fact, this summer, a Russian vessel continually harassed a Swedish research vessel, which was laying a new fiber optic cable connecting Sweden to Lithuania.
Conley, though, believes the U.S. and Russian coast guards should continue to cooperate in the Arctic, in part to keep the channels of communication open. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A police detective who investigated the John Hartman murder case took the stand at the Fairbanks 4 exoneration hearing. Retired officer Aaron Ring defended how police identified and gathered evidence that led to the charging and conviction of George Freese, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent for the deadly beating of Hartman on a downtown street in the early morning hours of October 11, 1997. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Detective Aaron Ring was a central player in identifying the Fairbanks Four as suspects within a day of the Hartman attack. Ring pointed to questioning of Eugene Vent in an early admission by the teen.
I was talking about the assault at 9th and Barnett, and that this person had been in a fight and was injured, and I wanted to know what the person had been hit with. And he said all they had was their feet, and I hadn't mentioned kicking or anything.
Ring defended interview and interrogation techniques like providing the suspects information, including fake evidence.
Sometimes you have to give them information to get information back. I think Eugene Vent called it a negotiation in our first interview.
That's drawn criticism for possibly coaxing false confessions from Vent and George Freese, who had been drinking heavily and complained of blackouts. Under cross-examination, Fairbanks 4 attorney Jonna Lindemuth pressed him on the issue.
Isn't it your experience that you get less reliable information from somebody who's drunk?
That depends. Sometimes someone who's lying to you and they're completely sober is a better liar.
State Attorney Ali Rahoy asked Ring how he leveraged Freese to confess.
I told him I had information. I was going to go find Marvin Roberts, that maybe he had been driving them around that night. And I was going to go talk to Marvin. He had a car that matched a description.
Okay. And did that prompt Mr. Freese to volunteer anything?
The very next words out of his mouth.
And what were those, do you recall?
I just kicked him a couple of times.
Rahoy also asked Ring about how officers drew incriminating information from Kevin Pease by picking up a pair of shoes at his house.
Lieutenant Ray Miller said you should check those.
And what was Mr. Pease's reaction?
Those shoes don't have blood on them.
So what was your reaction to that statement?
Why would he make that statement?
The state is expected to finish calling its witnesses in the Fairbanks 4 hearing this week. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The number of people with Alzheimer's disease in Alaska is expected to increase by more than 70% in the next decade. That's because people are living longer and seniors are staying in the state instead of moving out. People with severe memory loss and their caregivers require more services, like daytime activity centers. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman learned more about living with the disease by visiting Daybreak in South Anchorage.
77-year-old Vivian Cole walks laps around the second floor of the Diamond Center Mall, music blaring from a nearby store. Her conversation touches on some topics over and over. Her children, fearing the snow, and her years living in Moose Pass.
Loved it down there, but that was years ago. My kids were
tiny.
Little, yeah.
Cole has severe memory loss and can't spend the day alone. While her daughter works, she participates in programs with Daybreak, an activity center that cares for adults who have Alzheimer's disease and severe memory loss. The idea behind the center is to keep people active and to provide some respite for the caregivers.
Without Daybreak, I could not have a job.
That's Liz Hunt, the director of the center, quoting a comment made by a caregiver. Hunt explains that Daybreak is for people in the middle stage of Alzheimer's. For the first 7 years of the disease, people can usually function independently, so long as they can follow a list of reminders. For the next 7 years, they can't be left alone for long periods.
They need somebody to say, hey, it's time for us to stand up. We've been sitting for a while, or I want us to do this activity together, and I need your help, so come with me. And then the person will join in.
Hunt says they follow a regular schedule. Social activities and exercise in the morning, like walking at the mall. Some solo activities or listening to music after lunch. But she says the programs offered at Daybreak and around the state won't be enough as the senior population explodes.
I think we need to be ahead of the curve. Like you're talking about, we know these statistics. We know this is coming. We should put in the infrastructure to care for our seniors. That includes looking at all avenues. You know, do we need more adult day? Do we need more in-home services? Do we need to look at what types of benefits seniors are eligible for? Transportation is a big issue.
Not being able to drive was a major conversation point when a group of Daybreak clients sat down to talk about aging. It's that loss of independence, more than a loss of memory, that characterizes aging for 80-year-old Bunny Williams. She says she came up to Alaska to visit her daughter, and her daughter wouldn't let her go back home.
When you get older, you think you still can do all these things.
Oh, of course.
But you can't. But you don't want to admit that to yourself. So they admit it for you.
For her, the memory loss is just frustrating.
Yeah, you feel like you've lost your marbles.
Yeah, that's...
sometimes.
So you
and I was a school teacher with a college degree, and I can't remember where I left my dress or something, you know.
But some things she'll never forget, like the story of her birth. She came prematurely and weighed only 2.5 pounds. The doctor had to give her mouth to mouth.
My dad called me his little bunny because I was so tiny. And it stuck. Here's this big person still being called bunny. But even my teachers at school did not know my real name unless they looked at the permanent record card, because everyone called me Bunny.
It's the third time she shared the story that day, but it still sounds fresh and energetic. And for the record, her real name is Eleanor Rose. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The Smithsonian is using 3D printing and scanning technology to preserve and repatriate Huna Indian Association items. But because they're culturally sensitive objects, being able to make infinite copies isn't necessarily a good thing. At last week's Sharing Our Knowledge Clan conference in Juneau, KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins learned how tribal members are adapting the new technology.
A group of people crowd around a small table at the back of a conference room at Centennial Hall. The 3D printed objects are carefully laid out. They're gray and beige. Most are not painted yet. Although these items are replicas, we are advised we can look, but we can't touch. Robert Starbard, the tribal administrator for the Huna Indian Association, handles the copies with gloves.
Could you describe what one of the objects is?
Because they're shamanic, I've been asked by our elders not to do that.
The original items are yak, objects that have a spirit embedded in them. Eric Hollinger, a repatriation case officer at the Smithsonian, says traditionally, they would have been left at the above-ground grave houses of Tlingit shamans.
Some shamanic objects have actually been passed on from multiple shamans. They may be hundreds of years old before they were removed and sold into museums illegally.
After a repatriation request, the ownership was transferred back to the Huna Indian Association in 2013. But the items remain in the Smithsonian.
They're on a 5-year loan to us while we explore this project together and CT scan it.
That's right, a CT scan. Like the medical machine that shows the inside of your body. Except the scan creates 3D digital renderings that can be printed or studied. In 2005, the National Museum of Modern History repatriated a killer whale hat belonging to the Tlingit Declawadee. With the clan's permission, the hat was recreated. It's now used for educational purposes and in the museum's exhibition. During the panel, Robert Starbert said that most of Huna's cultural items were lost in a fire in 1944.
In one of the few places that we actually had access to some of these cultural objects that were otherwise, quote unquote, stolen from us, were in the museums.
He said the partnership with the Smithsonian provides two things: copies of the items in case something happens, and there are educational opportunities.
Where we could then take these objects and with our elders and our youth actually start sharing some of the stories and some of the histories and some of the techniques that went with them.
Throughout the process, Starbert has been consulting with the elders and will continue to do so about the item's sensitive nature. He says it's never easy to take a new technology and start using it for something that's culturally and historically significant to the clans.
There's a level of suspicion, there's a level of distrust, and there's a apprehension to move forward, which is why we're doing it in a very incremental, very slow process.
The Hoona Indian Association is involved in another repatriation claim with the University of Pennsylvania. So far, Starbert says the college hasn't been receptive, but he hopes the partnership with the Smithsonian can serve as an example.
Even if they are replicas for display, or in the case of UPenn, they're sitting in the back rooms, that perhaps we might be able to move that relationship off of the standoff that we have now.
Tlingit artists in Hoona are painting the items and milling their own paddles and masks from the scans. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
A research paper published yesterday says large Ice Age mammals may have gone extinct in northern Alaska when grassland turned to peat and rising sea levels covered the Bering Land Bridge. Alaska and California researchers studied bones of Ice Age horses, steppe bison, and woolly mammoths to determine why they died out. Lead author Daniel Mann says the Earth's environment was much more unstable during the Ice Ages and flipped back and forth every few thousand years. He says during the times when grasslands were abundant, large animals would have been attracted to northern Alaska. Mann says when the Earth's large ice sheets collapsed at the end of the last ice age, the melt caused sea level rise, which cut off a migration route back to Asia. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Rachel Waldholtz and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Ron Zastro. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.